All right, good afternoon, everyone. As you well know, the president's initiative to shut down refugees or people from seven countries into the United States is tied up, I think, in the Ninth Appellate Court right now. And Trump's having a fit with it. And here's an article we found. Where, David?
It was on my Flipboard feed.
Yeah.
Under the Christian heading, anyway.
Okay. Quartz. Any idea what that is? Because that's the heading at the very top. It says, the Bible has a very clear message about refugees. We should accept them. Matthew Schmaltz. Schmaltz. February 6,
2017.
What's that?
He said, you're killing me, Schmaltz.
Don't have a name like that, then, you know? I mean, all right, so let's get started.
On January 27th, President Donald Trump signed an executive order that placed a stay on refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries. Entrance of refugees from Syria, however, will be banned for the next 120 days. 2 days prior to that, he committed the United States to building a wall on its border with Mexico. Soon after the order, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto canceled an upcoming trip to the United States. President Trump has also proposed that Mexican goods be taxed at the rate of 20% to provide funds for building the wall. This would fulfill his campaign promise that Mexico would actually pay for the wall's construction, in spite of America's southern neighbors' protests. For Christians, the questions about building the border wall or permitting immigrants and refugees into the United States involve a host of associated considerations, not just about the specifics of immigration law, the economics of cheap labor coming across the border, or potential terrorist threats. At issue are both broader and deeper questions about what it means to welcome a stranger. As a Roman Catholic scholar who lived in South Asia for 4 years, I know what it's like to be initially considered a stranger, but be quickly welcomed with open arms. And I, like all Christians, look to the Bible for guidance when asking about how to best welcome the stranger. So what does the Bible actually say?
All right, so this guy's a Roman Catholic?
Yeah.
And a scholar.
Yeah, Roman Catholic scholar.
Yes.
Strongly and unequivocally, the obligation to treat strangers with dignity and hospitality. In the Love the Stranger, an article written for the annual meeting of the College Theological Society in 1991, Bible scholar Alice LaFay stated that in the Hebrew Bible, the words ger, G-U-R, and ger, G-E-R, are the ones most often glossed as referring to the stranger, though they are translated as newcomer and alien or resident alien, respectively. In the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, the word ger, G-E-R, appears almost 50 times, and the fifth book, Deuteronomy, delineates the number of specific provisions for treating the stranger, not just with courtesy, but also with active support and provision. For example, the book of Deuteronomy sets out the requirement that a portion of produce be set aside by farmers every third year for strangers, widows, and orphans. In the temple sermon attributed to the prophet Jeremiah, the Jewish people are exhorted to not oppress the sojourner. Within the Hebrew Bible, the requirements of hospitality are sometimes affirmed in very striking ways, as in the story from the book of Judges, in which a host offers his own daughter to ruffians in order to safeguard his guests. Of course, the Israelites themselves were strangers during their enslavement in Egypt and captivity in Babylon. The Hebrew Bible recognizes that every one of us can be a stranger, and for that very reason, we need to overcome our fear of those who live among us whom we do not know.
Wow. Where do we go from here? I mean, what?
Yeah, where do you even begin with that? Because it's just straight out of context.
Yeah, context would be wonderful.
Without the context. There are so many points that I'd like to point out in, let's just stay in his context. You want to stay in the Old Testament? You want to talk about sojourners and strangers? Well, let's talk about the balancing fact that God required the Israelites to go in and kill people in a land in such a manner as to leave the homes and everything standing so that the Israelites could possess the land. So we're talking about God-ordained aggression, not just trying to keep out the bad guys from your own place, but God actually told them to be the aggressor, go in and kill this people group in Canaan and this people group and this people group. And the point was, I'm going to give you their houses. The food's going to be so fresh, it's still going to be in the refrigerator, and you're not going to even have to farm it. And then we've got this admonition, which is certainly true, in the law, which we're supposed to treat sojourners with respect. But in imbalance, the idea that anyone who was an alien outside of the belief in Yahweh could become welcomed within by just believing in Yahweh, but you couldn't maintain, you know...
Right.
You couldn't maintain your belief in another god. You just couldn't do it.
Yeah, the Canaanites didn't get to come inside the camp.
Right, and still worship the Canaanite gods.
Exactly.
And be welcomed and be okay with that.
So there certainly are examples in which some people were converted.
They could pass through the land and pluck the corn or be treated courteously, but it was kind of, you know, move on down the road. You're not going to come in and, you know, pollute what we have.
It's one thing to visit, it's another to stay.
Yeah, I mean, well, look at his examples, and we've got, okay, the strangers in the Deuteronomic law there, and then you've got, well, I was a stranger in Southeast Asia, you know, and you've seen the memes going around that Jesus was a refugee when he went to Bethlehem. None of those three examples fit what we're talking about right here.
Especially the fact that he made it all and owns it all. That's
true. You know, and it was his hometown, too. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, you want to talk the Egypt trip, okay, but not the trip to Bethlehem. You know, and Israel's not on the banned list, so he would have been able to fly right into the United States.
but it's interesting, you know, this is I don't want to get completely off topic, but this is indicative of Roman Catholic use of the Word of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no clear citations here.
Yeah.
You just kind of give reference to Hebrew and you give reference to prophets' names. You know, the fact that it's mentioned 50 times, it doesn't say how it's mentioned, but just the fact that it's there 50 times shows us that we need to be welcoming to them.
The word stranger is there 50 times.
Right, so therefore that tells you that we don't need to. And this is indicative of how Roman Catholics adopt doctrine, build their worldviews. There's no real need to be careful with the contextual application of the passage.
Well, and it fits really well with the Pope's current narrative on this too. So he's being a
right.
Good
Don't
guy.
Build walls, build bridges. That whole type of a scenario.
And I think that it is part of the same argument that we're discussing today, because I think the at root issue is the fact that the Catholic Church sees themselves as the sovereign rather than as God of the universe as the sovereign. And the problem with all these discussions, if you have them outside of the context of God is sovereign, then you're having a ridiculous argument.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Without solutions.
All right, so before we get into the legitimacy of the conversation, which we want to get to, what is the appropriate Christian perspective? We want to make sure that we answer that question. Let's finish the article, because now he's going to go to the New Testament.
All right. The stranger is Jesus in disguise. Within the New Testament, which Christians read in continuity with the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, the most often cited passage dealing with welcoming the stranger is from Matthew 25:31-40. This section speaks of the final judgment, when the righteous will be granted paradise and unrepentant sinners will be consigned to eternal fire. Christ says to those at his right hand that they are blessed because I was hungry and you gave me food, I was thirsty and you gave me drink, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. The righteous then ask, when did we see you a stranger and welcome you? And Christ replies, truly I say to you, as you did to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. As Matthew 25 makes clear, the Christians should see everyone as Christ in the flesh. Indeed, scholars argue that in the New Testament, stranger and neighbor are in fact synonymous. Thus, the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself, refers not just to people whom you know, your neighbors, in a conventional sense, but also people whom you do not know.
Beyond, so let's stop there. You cannot read a sentence that says, as Matthew 25 makes clear, the Christian should see everyone as Christ in the flesh. You can't read that sentence and just keep going on. I mean, listen to what he just said. The Christians, which of course is not grammatically correct, but we'll fix it. The Christian should see everyone as Christ in the flesh. So I am to see Hitler as Christ in the flesh. I mean, you have to make your point by using an extreme example to show the ridiculousness of saying that I should see everyone as Christ in... I mean, that's just absurdity, Steve.
Yeah.
Well, everyone? So the man who is raping my wife should be seen as Christ in flesh. The man who is kidnapping a small child should be seen as Christ. Can I help you? Did you need a cup of water as you're doing it? I mean, let's stop the nonsense. How do you even get to write something like that? You know what I'm saying, David? How do you even get to type that kind of a statement and then people nod their head? Oh, okay. You just see little old Catholics reading is going, oh, I see. You know, ISIS is putting human beings in cages. Mm-hmm. Cages. That's Christ in flesh? Protestants having stones wrapped around their ankles and thrown off of a boat and being drowned to death. Oh, Christ in flesh again? I mean, it's just ridiculous. What are you looking up, David?
Where he says, scholars say that stranger and neighbor are synonymous. I don't know where he's getting, I don't know what scholar, and I just noticed no scholars cited there, but scholars say this. Well, the word for neighbor is plesion. It means neighbor, it means friend. In a Jewish mind, it meant fellow Jews. And then foreigner or stranger is xenos, where we get xenophobia from and all that. It's a foreigner, it's a stranger, it's an alien.
It's two different words.
Yeah. Now, I guess you can extrapolate the idea that, okay, I can treat a stranger as a neighbor, but they're two different words.
And I remember when I talked through Ephesians, and I remember kind of going through that, one was like, you know, you weren't a citizen of Rome, or, you know, I think back in that, you know, it wasn't like you were a citizen of Rome, but you were granted permission to live within the city and be part of the community, mm-hmm. as opposed to... You know, you had the citizen of Rome, then you had the one that they weren't a citizen of Rome, but they were granted permission to live there and be among the citizens. And then the third was, you know, you weren't a citizen of Rome, you weren't part of that community, you were just kind of traveling through.
Yeah.
And you might stop by to spend the night or whatever, but, you know, you were not welcome just to permanently reside there. You were, mm-hmm. you know, it was the idea of, you know, you were the alien or the foreigner just passing through, going somewhere else.
Yeah, that all strangers are not neighbors and all neighbors are not strangers. There's no way you can make that equivocation, you know, even though scholars have said so.
Yeah, and once again, context is king.
Mm-hmm.
Because right before this passage that is so quoted and misquoted as being Christians, the ultimate ideal for a Christian is to be loving and accepting of everyone, which is certainly... You know, this verse has been used to make that kind of case. God is separating believers from unbelievers and sending some to hell. In fact, the parable before that, the wicked servant, the person who had a lot, was given even more. And that totally flies in the face of equality and everything that we think is right and just in this newfangled movement. And so the problem is these parables and this stuff is given in context. And it's primarily driven to talk about Christ as the Messiah.
Well, in the same way that I'm not going to mention the fact that the Jews go into Canaan and destroy strangers in the Old Testament, I certainly cannot give you a contextual understanding of Matthew 25. I just have to cherry pick. I mean, that's what we're doing here. Various verses, because I have a political bias. And that political bias is you need to let people into your nation who may do it harm.
And I can pull a story like the Good Samaritan and say, well, look, you know, here's Jesus saying that this man that you hate is your neighbor, and therefore we should take care of all neighbors or all strangers. And the fact is, did Jesus heal everyone that was sick in Israel when he came in? He didn't.
No.
Did he take care of all the social problems when he came into Israel? No, because that's not what he was there for. You know, that wasn't his purpose. And so this idea of, you know, Christ and all these people, and, you know, the theology there is just all jacked up if we look at it from that perspective.
Yeah, because I would be, if you ask the man on the street, they might know the verse about, you know, when did you do it unto, you know, when I did it unto the least of thee, that's when he did it unto Christ, that concept at least, if they didn't know the word for word verse. But I'll have, if you ask them if this verse was in the Bible, they say, no, definitely not. For to everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. From the one who has not, even what he will, it will be taken away.
No, I don't know what Bible you're reading.
That's not a Bernie Sanders quote.
No. You know, yes, folks, that's in the Bible.
Yeah, and nobody's saying we don't want to help people.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the problem, is either we take every single refugee, or you're a horrible person and you're trying to, you want people to die. You know, and that's the narrative that's being pushed.
And certainly there are scriptures, there's many balancing scriptures about taking care of the orphans, the widows, the stranger, showing compassion. Jesus even himself said you should to show compassion to your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But
he used
the word enemy.
Yeah.
He used the word enemy and opposer. So it wasn't like this.
He said forgive them.
No,
he didn't say move them into your house.
Right.
Well, the 50 times that they talk about in the Old Testament, if you take it into context, sometimes it says, okay, this is what you and the sojourner in your house, the stranger in your land, is supposed to do. And since you're doing it and they're living peacefully and doing it also, then they will also benefit in the corporate blessing that I'm announcing for the nation of Israel. And if you, Israel, if you don't do this, then you and the stranger in your land are both going to be cut off. So there was the idea of the stranger dwelt in the land as long as the stranger was lawfully dwelling in the land. And therefore, I'm sure there was some sort of vetting process.
The lawful part is the and there was a hospitality expectation in the ancient world,
provided you lived lawfully and peacefully.
Exactly. But I don't remember, you know, Israel getting into caravans and boats and going to other nations and bringing people in. That's why it's so out of context. You know, that wasn't the idea. The idea was I provide hospitality for somebody that's passing through. I don't set them up with health care. You know, I don't have to do that. I leave them gleanings from the field. You know, that was the protection.
Well, are we done with the article? Is there some more? Let's finish this thing so we can get to the real issue.
All right. Beyond this, in the letters written by Paul of Tarsus, one of the most notable of early Christian missionaries.
I'm glad they let us know that. Like, we wouldn't
know. Often
you have to do that because of who you're writing to, David. That is not assumed.
Yeah. Often known as the Pauline epistles, it is made clear that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female.
From no males or females.
Context.
I don't really know what I am.
Gender neutral.
Right? Don't call me a male. Paul said, I don't know what I am.
How say let the women be silent then?
No, that's right. There are none.
if you identify as a woman.
Come on.
Man,
if they would just identify as men, they could speak all they wanted.
Yeah.
We solved it.
Yeah.
LGBTQ, and the Q stands for questioning. I'm not really sure who I am.
From this perspective, being one in Christ should be taken literally as acknowledging no fundamental differences in kind among human beings. And the Bible is unambiguous in its message, is the last section. Of course, in Christianity, the strong admonitions toward treating the stranger with dignity have coexisted with actions that would seem to indicate an opposite attitude. Pogroms against Jews, slavery, imperialism, and colonialism have been sanctioned by Christians who nonetheless would have affirmed biblical principles regarding caring for those who seem other or alien. Indeed, when it comes to the specific questions concerning building a wall on America's borders with Mexico or welcoming immigrants and refugees, some Christians would argue that doing so does not violate any biblical precept concerning hospitality to the stranger, since the issue is one of legality. And, of course, a good number of Christians did indeed support Donald Trump's candidacy for the presidency. Other Christians have taken a diametrically different position and have called for cities and educational institutions to be set apart as safe zones for undocumented immigrants. It is true that the application of biblical principles to contemporary matters of policy is less than clear to the many Christians who have taken opposing sides regarding how the United States should deal with immigrants, undocumented workers, and refugees. However, in my reading of the Bible, the principles regarding welcoming the stranger are broad-reaching and unambiguous.
This is said in my reading of the Bible. That's exactly true.
Yeah, that is very true. It is absolutely his reading of the Bible. Jack, what are your thoughts? A student asks you, since you're our high school and middle school administrator and elementary administrator and preschool administrator and the whole bang of wax, what do you say? What's the biblical perspective?
I think the biblical perspective is it's on a case-by-case basis, first and foremost. Is the individual willing to be lawful and dwell in peace? I believe our president is attempting to slow the process to get a better discernment on who and who should not be brought into the country, especially when they're coming from hotbeds of terrorism, so that we can ensure that those who do come into our country will be a benefit to our country, not a drain on our country, and will live peacefully. And should they do that, and they move next door to me, then I should be neighborly to them.
So there's a couple questions then, right? Does the government have the right to do this? That would be a biblical question. How should I treat them if they're here? I mean, so there are layers of questions here. Steve?
Obviously, I think the government has the right to do that. I mean, God established the guidelines for Israel. And again, I mean, they weren't inviting the warring country. You know, when they were at war with the Philistines, they weren't going, hey, if you Philistines, come on in and set up camp right here among us. And, you know, if you want to blow up a few houses and cities, go for it. You know,
well, in fact, if you look at the interaction between King Saul and Samuel takes Saul to task for saving portions of the Amalekites.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because God said destroy all of them, and he saved the king and the sheep and the goats and, you know, the best of it, and then he claimed, it was just a sacrifice, and Samuel said, God doesn't want your sacrifice, God wants your obedience. But, you know, as Jack said, I appreciate the president taking a stand and just trying to slow the process down and saying, you know what, let's make, and again, not in a prideful way or proud way, but saying, you know, let's keep America safe. Let's, you know, make sure that who we are allowing into our countries are not coming with the intent to harm and hurt and destroy us from within.
And
that's what we've seen, you know, the whole 9/11. You know, why did that happen? Well, we allowed people in to our country for various reasons or whatever without vetting them properly, and they damaged from within. You know, they didn't send a nuclear missile from Russia or from Iraq. I mean, they infiltrated the country and then used that their positions within to hurt us, to hurt our country, to hurt the people that want to be in America.
And you know what's so sad about all of this is this president is not doing anything that the last president didn't do.
Right.
He's not doing what the president before him did it. You know, so Obama did it. Bush did it. Clinton did it. Bush did it.
Carter did it.
Reagan did it.
Yeah.
Carter did it. And Reagan, like Obama, also, hey, let's grant citizenship to undocumented. I mean, let's be honest about this. The fact of the matter is we are a sovereign nation, and we have the right, and he is the executive who has the right. In the words of President Obama, I invite somebody to challenge my authority given to me by the Constitution to place this ban and slow down these refugees from entering our nation. I mean, he stood in a press conference on national television and gave that same speech. This president doesn't give a speech. He backs up his platform. He signs an executive order, and the nation loses its mind.
All right, so let's do our best to separate two things, okay? So Trump's initiative that's caused the whole uproar versus just does a nation have the right? Because certainly we could agree, I think, perhaps around this table, that if Trump had just slowed down a little bit and been a little bit more deliberate with the process, some of this wouldn't have happened. Okay, but
perhaps.
Just set that aside.
Yeah, if he set aside Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he ain't doing that, man. I'm telling you. The man is addicted to it, evidently. Does a nation have the right to establish boundaries, borders?
I would say so, based upon the command that we are created in the image of God, and Proverbs tells us.
Are you talking about land or people, or both?
Do nations have the ability to establish this is our land and this is our boundary?
I would say so. As far as like build a wall around it and say this is our...
Yep, right,
we,
that
we
idea.
We see in Genesis, God creates the heavens and the earth, so God and his creation established boundaries and borders for where land. Proverbs tells us he established where the tides, where the water could go, where it could not. When it comes to him giving Abraham land, he says, you go to this line, and this is where your land stops. You go to this sea, this is where your land stops. And he tells Abraham, this is your border. So, and then we see David with the same thing, that he is in charge of that. So I think we see a demonstration in Scripture where God would say, as my image, who is exercising dominion over this area that I have given you, you control it.
All right.
Yeah, from a purely, you know, legal, political, nationalistic standpoint, I think borders are clearly recognized, clearly a good thing. You think about the idea of God setting the limits of the habitations.
Yeah, I was going to read that to it us.
It's just like, you know, I know where my lot line is. I own a piece of land, and I have corners and...
Right, and the question is that biblical, Steve, or should you leave your doors open, leave your garage open? Because, I mean, you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth.
Well, it's
you can't lock
biblical.
Your cars.
Yeah.
You can't lock your cars and then protest the refugees that are coming into your country. I mean, if you want refugees in your country, open your doors, open your garage, leave the keys available for whoever.
Yeah. And if Steve wants to put a bunch of tents in his backyard and let people live in his backyard, that's his prerogative to do so. Right, because it's his land.
Right, and again, you go back to the Old Testament. Every tribe was given
an allotment.
Yes. Abraham was given. Okay, these are all your boundaries, and then it was divide that up among 11 tribes.
Okay, so I'll read to the audience Acts 17:26. The Apostle Paul, Mars Hill. From one man he hath made every nationality to live over the whole earth, and has determined their appointed times and the boundaries of where they live. Now we ask ourselves, let's think about this for just a moment, listener. How does God establish those boundaries? Because you said, Abraham, here's the land. Steve, you mentioned tribes. But God's not doing that presently. Okay?
Right.
God has not presently communicated the boundary between Canada and the United States. So how does he do it today? Well, we believe he does it through image bearers.
Romans 13.
Right, well, that there is nobody established that isn't there because what?
Governments are established by God.
Yeah, the government is established by God. You were getting ready to say something?
I was going to say, as far as the boundaries of the U.S., the boundaries of Canada, I mean, that was all established when, you know, the U.S. purchased land from different...
Yes, by image bearers. The image bearers of God fulfilling the...
Treaties amongst one another. Yeah.
Right, through the covenant that God established in the Garden of Eden, that we are to have dominion and subdue this land. So image bearers ordained by God, according to Romans 13, establish boundaries. And what Paul says, because Paul's talking there about a boundary established by the Roman nation.
Mm-hmm.
Not a boundary established by God, like the Abrahamic covenant or the Davidic covenant. This is Rome.
Yeah, and you know, you take it even further, God's sovereignty and that sort of thing is having Paul born in Tarsus, where he receives a Roman citizenship, which is going to allow him access to places 30 years down the line in order to share the gospel with people that would never hear it. I mean, citizenship means something. You know?
Yes, it means something, and I'm trying to establish that the very boundaries that we have between nations today have been ordained by God. Either God is appointing the leaders, or he's not. You can't have it both ways.
Either sovereign or he's not.
Right, exactly. So then the next argument that I would want to purport is, what's the purpose of government? And Peter tells us pretty clearly, 1 Peter 2:14, that it's to punish those that do evil and reward or praise those that do what? Good. Right, good. That. So
Paul also talks about Romans 13.
And Paul also talks about
protect the innocent, punish the guilty.
Exactly.
And tax you.
And they tax you by extension.
The most biblical approach to allowing refugees in is to measure whether the country they're coming from or the place or the culture they're coming from protects the innocent and follows and does which is good.
Or John, when you're coming through my land, through that vetting process, If I think there's a probability, a greater probability to do evil versus good, you can't come in.
I don't have to let you through.
Right. Right.
Because
this
you're
is my
protecting
boundary.
The people that
That's
are already
right.
in there.
And I'm charged, according to God's word, with the responsibility of punishing those who do evil and rewarding those who do good behavior. So if you're a doctor and you're going to work in a hospital and we need doctors in that field mm-hmm. and you're going to help do good, then I welcome you into my nation. If you're coming from a land that has a known propensity to do evil against us, that is, you take planes and fly them into buildings with people on them, then you can't come into my... I want to argue with our Roman Catholic scholar that he's wrong. Mm-hmm. That he's wrong. That it has to, as you said, Jack, it has to be measured on a case-by-case basis. And if I believe that you are here to do good to our nation, then I welcome you as a stranger into our nation. If I believe that you are here to do wrong, then I don't welcome you. I mean, let's ask the Roman scholar. He looks across the way at his neighbor, who is a Muslim orientation, and he sees that in his garage, he's building bombs. Does he welcome that guy and continue to give him food and water in the name of Jesus? Or does he pick up the phone and call 911? Because if you see something, say something. Which does he do?
Yeah, and even if it doesn't even get to that point, it's, okay, here's a guy that I don't know, but he's coming from a place that has a propensity for those sort of actions. Do I just give him the benefit of the doubt and let him live next door to me? You know, now like Jack said earlier, it's one thing if he's, okay, he comes in, he lawfully moves in. Well, he's my neighbor. I am obligated to love my neighbor now, right? But I don't put my family at risk and my fellow citizens at risk by bringing somebody in the name of political correctness, right? The media narrative is it's a Muslim ban, which is totally misguided. And second of all, they say, well, there's never been a foreign national from one of those countries that's committed a crime. There's a judge on the West Coast that was saying that, and it's gone all over viral and everything else. Well, it turns out there's been 76 people from those countries arrested in the last 10 years that it could have been suspected of terrorist plots. So just because they haven't been successful, you know, and really the whole thing is they say, well, look, why don't we ban Saudi Arabia? Because the guys that flew the planes in, most of those were Saudis. Well, like we said earlier, the vetting process wasn't very good back then, and they managed to slip through. The fact is, in those seven countries that he named, there's no central government. It's radicalized. They have no vetting possibilities. We can still vet with Saudi Arabia.
And see, that becomes the issue.
Yeah.
I mean, Saudi Arabia is cooperating with us.
Yes.
We're operating within the boundaries of Saudi Arabia to make insertion into Iraq and other places. We've been doing that for a decade.
20 years.
So... Does that government have, whether to our level or not, some modicum of being what you described, a government that rewards right and punishes evil? Now, they might define it slightly different than us.
But that's not the issue. God-ordained authority.
And they're operating as an authority. They're doing their best. So we work with them. But because they do have cracks in their system... We do a 120-day delay versus, like you said, I don't know what this government's going to do. It's completely renegade. Who knows what's happening? And they may say, yeah, we're vetting the good people, when really what they're doing is pumping a steady stream of terrorists.
So we have Mexicans who are continually bringing drugs into America through a border along the southern region from Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, all the way over to California. All right. Does that help our nation or does that hurt our nation? All right, that hurts our nation. So then we're going to build a wall in order to we can't eliminate it, but we're going to try to cut it down by 50%.
And have we banned any Mexicans from immigrating into the country?
No.
We're just saying you got to come through these doors
let
right
us
here.
Know if you want to come.
Yeah, we want you to come through these doors right here.
Yeah. Just come through the gate that says Border Patrol.
Right.
Well, that's all we want.
One of the flawed problems, though, with the way the presentation, we're going to have to go back to that idea right now to discuss this issue, is I hear what you're saying, but the problem is there are sinners and evildoers currently residing in the United States that are citizens.
Absolutely.
So that, I think, is part of the problem with making the argument the way that they've chosen to make it. The talking point is that the bad guys are coming in, and certainly there are. But my point is this. Anyone who comes in my country when I've asked them not to is a bad guy because they've broken
my law.
Mm-hmm. So the little old mother who brings her two children to escape poverty to come in here, I'm sorry, but she's a lawbreaker But we don't want to hear that.
And no, but she is a lawbreaker.
She has broken the immigration law. You are supposed to live in Mexico. And the whole issue with this is we don't understand sovereignty. God placed her in Mexico. Am I compassionate and brokenhearted because I sit here where I have a meal every day, enjoy three good meals every day, and she's wondering where the next one's? Certainly am. You know, that doesn't stop my compassionate heart. But do I have the big answers for the world and the starving world? I don't.
No, you don't, John. But if that one that you're talking about, that lawbreaker, comes across, that doesn't keep you as a Christian from helping her with basic needs, that you're moved in compassion until such a time as ICE arrests her or her sin finds her out or whatever the case may be.
And so I think part of the problem has been the fact that the reality is that a flood of even well-meaning people trying to escape the drug culture or the poverty coming into the United States does have a measurable impact. And if you don't believe that, then what is the common narrative talking about if we're going to ban these people? Well, we're not going to have people to do these skilled jobs. We're not going to have this and this. Well, you can't, like you say, talk out of both sides of your mouth. Do they affect us or don't they affect us? And the reality is they've taken paying jobs that Americans wouldn't do, and they currently reside, not legally, but they currently reside in the United States doing those jobs so that we can enjoy some pretty low-cost vegetables, other products,
and watermelons,
chicken, just, you know, and there's segments of society in the way that we do things currently, both globally and nationally.
But the biblical issue is, does a sovereign nation have the right to ban or vet people? Because
right.
the narrative from the Roman Catholic Church is no walls, only bridges.
Right. Have you seen that picture of the Vatican? There's two walls.
That big wall around it.
So I think one of the hard issues is we're not going to gain much traction in discussing this with at least half of the country that believes that there is no sovereign anywhere in the universe.
Yes, they believe in a globalization and no one has the right to enforce their will upon someone else. And
they can't
then
figure out their own marriages and how that works because
right.
Who's supposed to be the boss? Am I? Is it you? Is it me? And, you know, and I mean, it's just, it's a mess.
Because truth is relative.
Right.
Well, there's two. I think there's two conversations. The border wall is one thing because Mexico's right there. You know, I can look over into Mexico and see.
And it's a problem.
Right, yeah. And it's a problem, right? And there should be protections in place. There should be protocols in place for people to come into the country. The whole refugee situation, which if we're not at least compassionate for the fact that these people are dealing with ISIS and everything else over there, and people are dying, Muslim, Christian alike, but that it's not like Mexico. It, you know, we're not a neighboring country. If we were a neighboring country, which, by the way, no neighboring countries are taking these refugees in, right? If there was a genocide going on across the border in Mexico, we'd have a whole different conversation to be having right here. Because I think it would be in our biblical mindset that they're 10 miles away, and we need to help those people.
Right. So okay, just a minute, John. So, David, if we care about the refugees, which you just said,
yeah.
Then why don't we go after the entity that's creating the refugee crisis?
Sure.
Because they don't want to live here any more than we want them to come here.
Yeah.
They want to live in their own nation.
Yeah, they do.
But the reason they're refugees is because there's this thing called ISIS that's forcing them to be refugees.
Mm-hmm.
So the most compassionate thing is to take a really big stick and go over there and knock them right between the eyes and get them back in their place.
See, and I think that the unfortunate problem with the way that Trump has done this is that's what he should be telling everyone. That's exactly what he should be telling everyone. That we're not going to just, you know, help you in the short term. We're going to help you in the long term. But I think that the world is now in a position where they're unwilling to do that because of this thing is dragged on and on. You know, in which we play with ISIS a little bit. We play, you know, with, you know, whatever the latest group is, just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But we're unwilling to really take extreme and drastic measures.
Right. The reality is my son is 22 years old. Your daughter's about the same age. And their entire life we've been at war.
Right.
They can never remember a day in which we haven't been at war.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we didn't fight it. If we fought World War II the way we fought this enemy, okay, we'd be speaking German or Japanese.
Yeah. Well, in that same 22 years, I don't know that there's been a clearly drawn objective on what the war was trying to accomplish.
That's correct.
Either, which is the problem.
Which is clearly the problem. Yeah. We've had multiple administrations. Nobody has clearly defined what the enemy is and what our goal is. Mm-hmm. And we're creating the refugee problem by not dealing with the root of the issue. And right now, the Trump administration is in chaos. Everything is being rolled out in chaos. Nothing's being vetted properly. Nothing. Two people from the same administration on CNN and Fox, and they're saying conflicting things. That's how much, and then you give the president a Twitter account, and he's saying a third thing. Am I wrong? It's ridiculous. It is absurdly ridiculous. By this time, they should have figured out that we need one person who speaks for the administration. And, Mr. President, you've got to give me your phone, okay? We'll let you know if somebody's calling you.
Yeah.
Yeah. David, I told my senior Bible class, based on right now, this is what we have. The House has a Republican, the Senate has a Republican, and then, that, of course, the executive branch, okay? We've got 10 more months in the year 2017. We've got 9 more months in the year 2018. And then the House is running for re-election. Mm-hmm. If the president, in my view, has got 19 months to figure out whether he's going to be a one-term president or whether he's going to be a two-term president. Because if he doesn't get his act together in the next 18 months, he'll lose the House, become lame duck, and it'll be over for him right there. Because what will he be able to get accomplished when we have a Democratic House and a Republican Senate? Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Well, it'll be more executive orders, and that'll cause more
animosity towards who he is, and all that will be was fuel to flip it around and put a Democrat back in office.
Which is why he got to office, by the way.
That's exactly why he got to office.
Nobody wants to admit the fact, I was all for executive orders there, but now I hate them. And the other side saying, well, I love executive orders then, but now they're unconstitutional. It's this whole thing of, it's good as long as I'm in power, but then when I'm not in power, I'm not for it. Well, you've just thrown ethics out the window. There's no
consistency.
There's no balance there.
Well, certainly no consistency, because if there was any consistency, then the talking point about the Muslim ban, and how un-American it is to deny them entry would just be ridiculous, because they're protesting women's rights. And if I can't think of another religion in the whole world,
not to mention homosexual rights
to women.
They only throw gay guys off the top of roofs.
It's the Muslim faith. Yeah. And so it's like, do you not see these things connected?
Well, I think it's funny with this unconstitutional thing that gets thrown around. So we've established that a nation has sovereignty to establish its own borders and its own vetting process. All the legislative bodies have said that this executive order is not unconstitutional. It holds up. Now, whatever the Ninth Circuit does, that's a whole other ballgame, because they've overstepped their bounds all over the place. But it's not unconstitutional there. Even if it was a Muslim ban, even if it was, which we know it's not, even if it was, how is that unconstitutional to them? Because they're not citizens. Right. They have no constitutional rights.
Right.
So you can't apply constitutional rights to people that aren't citizens of the United
States. Well, that's exactly like giving lawyers to the people down at Gitmo.
Yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me?
And the whole, when they were talking about putting them through civilian courts and
right,
everything.
Right, exactly. the same very thing.
I'm going to tell you right now, that is Obama's legacy.
Yeah.
That thinking is Obama's legacy. And it's going to be proven that he's on the wrong side of history a long time from now. But the idea that everybody has American rights, even though they're not American
citizens,
is going to come back to bite him and his legacy, because his fervor was obviously on that point.
Well, I've argued for a long time. It goes back to his anthropology is so far off that it screws up everything else. Because
mm-hmm.
he assumes everybody are good people.
Right. Right.
If we put our weapons down, they'll put their weapons down. If we give them rights, they'll give us rights. Mm-hmm. If we respect them, they'll respect us. And it's such a naive, irresponsible, ridiculous premise. Because if you could just get to the idea that men are sinners, if you just understood that men are dead in sin, it would change the whole way you dealt with people. And it doesn't mean you love them any less or respect them any less, but you wouldn't be an idiot,
Well, it's interesting that we're having this giant conversation about executive orders, because we need to distinguish the difference between a law and an executive order. Because an executive order is not binding upon the citizenry. It's a directive given to those people who work for the President of the United States. You have to be in the executive branch of the government to receive an executive order.
Right.
And the executive order has lots of limitations to it. It's not unconstitutional. For example, it has budgetary limits to it. The president can only give an order which is within the budget that's approved by the Congress. So if I tell you as the Secretary of the Navy to build 5 million ships and you only have a budget to build 10, you cannot do my executive order no matter what I've told you. Because, Mr. President, I only have money to do 10.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you tell me. Now, if he finds money to move to give you within his branch, then he's lawful to do that.
Right.
But a law, on the other hand, applies to Coca-Cola. A law applies to Exxon. A law applies to you, Brian. And laws have to go through the legislative procedure and can be overturned by a court. And people don't, they only want the president to have power to do things when it's the power that they like.
Right.
Exactly.
And so that begs the question, how can the state of North Carolina, who's been the latest one, to join this lawsuit against an executive order which doesn't even apply to them?
Right. It's
ridiculous. That makes no legalistic sense.
It's all political.
It is.
Every bit of it is.
And there's no reason that judge has any jurisdiction to decide the case either.
No. For an appellate court to decide that what the president is doing is unconstitutional is just absurdly ridiculous. And the reason everyone doesn't see it is because of the extreme ignorance when it comes to basic civics in America. It's your fault, Jack. You're one of those educators, and you haven't educated students well enough to know the difference between what right and wrong is.
Well, Jack, you've taught U.S. history like I have, so it doesn't take long in U.S. history to get to Marbury versus Madison.
I mean, you
right.
You don't even have to go that far, Dave.
Probably not.
You can go to the Whiskey Rebellion of Washington.
Yeah.
Executive order, very first one ever issued. I'm the commander-in-chief of the United States military. These guys are having an insurrection over here in Massachusetts. I'm done with it. Everybody, let's load up some troops. I'm getting on the horse. I'm going to be the commander-in-chief, the general in charge. I'm leading from the front. We go up there. We stop their little march, put them in their place, send them back home, confiscate their weapons, and we go back to where was it, New York or Philadelphia when the Capitol was there, and be done with
it. I think, you know, why Marbury versus Madison comes to mind is the judicial thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because
judicial review.
You know, what ends up happening for, you know, you non-history folks out there is John
That's
Adams.
That's the rest of us, David, okay?
So John Adams is a lame duck president, and so right before he gets out of office, he appoints a bunch of midnight justices, is what they call them. So I'm going to flood the courts with my guys, so we'll be taken care of. Well, when Jefferson takes over, he goes, whoa, that ain't going to fly. We're canceling these appointments. Well, one of the guys that gets an appointment sues James Madison, who's Secretary of State at the time, and says, you have to give me that appointment because the president issued it. Well, he goes to the Supreme Court, and John Marshall says, you know what? You're right. That appointment is binding because it was issued in a correct legal way. However, I'm a Supreme Court justice. I can't make them give it to you. Go talk to Congress about that. Right? And so the idea is, I can tell you, yeah, that's constitutional. You should be a justice. But it's not in my power to enforce that law because I'm a judge. I'm not a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
And that is gone. Now I make the judgment, I enforce it, I can legislate
right.
from the bench.
I legislate from the bench. And when you use those words, legislate from the bench, 9 out of 10 Americans have no clue what that means.
Right.
They are so ignorant. You do a man on the street interview and you say, what's the Supreme Court do? How many are there? How do they get there? And it's just utter absurd ignorance.
Yeah.
But that all started with Chief Justice Warren.
In the
50s and the 60s, when Chief Justice Warren came in, he was the first Chief Justice to begin judicial activism and began using loose construction for constitutional interpretation instead of strict construction and judicial conservatism. And from that point forward, every judge has taken it as, if I interpret the Constitution and I rule upon the Constitution, then I can impact society. And it's not their job to impact society.
No, it's interesting, though, that, Jack, you just mentioned loose construction as contrasted to what? Strict, right?
Strict construction.
What's really interesting for the Christian that's listening out there is the parallelism between Christian liberalism and Christian conservatism, because David, it's virtually identical.
Yeah, it's
how do you see the Word of God?
Well, yeah, you see that Jefferson versus Hamilton idea, and you know, Jefferson said if the Constitution doesn't say we can do it, then we can't do it. And Hamilton said, well, if it doesn't say we can't.
Yeah, it's really the regulative or the normative principles.
And so when you put that in the scriptural perspective, well, it doesn't say specifically that. Jesus never said anything
about that.
I can obviously do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Or I interpret the words of Paul in the context of this was a very gender segregated bias. So that has to
be... So I deconstruct it to fit my own
That's experience. Right. Yeah. And so surely if Jefferson was alive today, if George Washington was alive today, and they saw how gays are today, then they would have this perspective. Yeah. And so you have to reinterpret it as a living document that has some degree of truth, but certainly not enough to be prescriptive
today.
Not
truth, but contains truth. The same idea.
Exactly.
I mean, Alexander Hamilton's a hip-hop guy on Broadway now. So,
I think
who cares about history?
I think the good news in all of this is this is now coming to light as the major issue in America. I really do believe this because what we're seeing is now it's been kind of pulled back, the carpet's been pulled back, and we see that there's a whole generation that when they don't get their way, they throw a fit and expect to get their way.
Right, not my Super Bowl champions.
Right.
Yeah, I should have been in the streets on that one.
So the reality is, but what they're finding is there's a correlation principle between the amount that you're going to be a big baby and throw a fit and the amount of influence and power that you have. The more you act like an infant, the less power to change the situation you have.
Mm-hmm.
The more you follow the rules and play by the constitutionality, actually the more power you have. And I think that what you're going to see in the next 20 years, kind of like what we've seen with the church, with this neo-reformation kind of theology and people who are...
Kind of a resurgence, you're saying.
Yeah, and the whole seeker-sensitive kind of fizzled out. And because what we're seeing is a really kind of a return to the idea that, you know, the country are as good as its laws. And I think that's going to really show itself. And we're kind of at a tipping point. I know people say that all the time. But I've never heard as much discussion about these civic ideas as I have since, you know, Trump got a Twitter account.
Well, there's such a difference between a high school grad of the 1980s, a high school grad of the 1950s, a high school grad of 2015. I mean, the level of awareness, competency, basic knowledge is just, I mean, I ask my high school students the same questions once a week because repetition seems to help on, like, how many branches of government are there again now? I mean, and you're like, are you kidding me? That's a question that a sixth grader had locked down. You know, there's just such a absence of understanding of anything that is legitimately necessary to function as a human being. You know, I don't need to know anything. I can Google it.
Well, can I give two parallels on this?
I'd love to hear them.
First, the Bible says the simple believe every word.
The simple believe every word.
Okay? Now, if I'm the all-controlling government that wants you to be a good subjective citizen, I can't teach you what the Constitution says. So therefore, I'm going to teach you social science instead of teaching you constitutional history.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. Which is interesting because is that why the teachers union is having such a fit with the boss getting into office there? Because she's all about charter schools. She's all about private schools. She's about schools that there isn't that common core influence in which we get to decide what we think is good for education.
Well, again, the biblical parallel to what Jack is saying too is I'm not going to teach you. I'm not going to preach to what the Word says.
That's right.
I'm gonna give you some stuff out here.
Well, look at this article that I'm holding in my hand.
That's a good example.
I'm not going to tell you where a chapter and verse is because you know what you might do? You might go read what I actually said.
Well, you've seen evangelism programs where you don't quote chapter and verse to people because that just turns them off.
Well, go back to our colonial days. Alexis de Tocqueville came over in the 1830s. Many years, you know, what, three, four, almost five decades after the American Revolution. But he had this comment about it was almost every home I visit in America, whether it's a farmer's home, a blacksmith's home, a carpenter's home, there's a lawyer in the home.
There's a lawyer in the home.
There's a lawyer in the home,
And that goes back to William Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England being the number one selling book leading up to the revolution in the United States, because the United States, back then colonial colonies, had a 2-to-1 ratio in literacy over England. England was almost illiterate as a by and large as a nation, and the colonies were almost 67-70% literate, and they're reading the laws and commentaries on the laws of England written by England's most premier lawyer and going, wait a minute, the king is breaking the laws. This is why we
who
can
was
list
writing from a biblical worldview, by the way.
So we can list 27 grievances where he broke British law and make a true stance to the world. This is why we're going to become a sovereign nation.
Mm.
And it's interesting that the whole liberal narrative in many cases is that education is the answer, which I would say knowledge is one of the answers, not education, because
right. You're
not necessarily getting knowledge or wisdom when you're getting educated.
Truth is the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Truth is the answer. I can educate you into any believing anything.
Yes, exactly.
And it's interesting because right now with the narrative from the public education is STEM, you know, science and math, those things are the answer. When if you look back in the Bible is actually a law book because it guides what society needs most, and that is the science of how people get along, and that's called laws. And God knew that man had a sinful nature, and God knew that there was atonement, and so he wrote the best law book there was.
I just knew you were about to make a pitch for the arts. That's where you were going.
Well, I'm going to.
The arts is a humanity which elevates man and seeks to put God down. I mean,
well,
I'm not proud of the arts at all.
Well, can I make somewhat of a semi-plug for the arts?
Make
based
one.
Upon your viewers? If we also got into the Bible, we would understand that God gave people talents and gifts, some to music so that they could praise him properly. He gave some artisans. He made them the craftsmen, the guys who would do the sewing for the temple, the guys who would do the gold overlay, the carpenters. But then he also gave the intellect, the Pauls, who would write the Bible. I mean, so the fact of the matter is not everybody's supposed to go to college. Some people are meant to work. Some people have been designed by God and called by God to be mechanics, welders, lawn care. I mean, you name it. Fried cooks. I mean, that's just the reality of it.
You know, back,
and
back
a society works
point,
when we have all of those pieces.
Yeah, and back to John's point of sovereignty earlier is maybe that person was supposed to be born in Mexico to develop a drive to be something else, to change something, to impact society. You know, and we just want to throw that out because everything's surrounded on the individual and their personal choice, not anything to God's glory. And that's the arts piece, right?
Well,
art is beautiful when it's to God's glory.
Right, sure. And
yeah. And
this also is another question that intersects with the refugee thing. It intersects with the love my neighbor as myself and Jesus saying, you know, the saying about if you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. And that is, okay, I look at Jesus and he sacrificed himself for people who kicked him, spit on him, beat him, and all of that. And I'm supposed to be Christ-like, so that means all the time I need to be walked on. Well, I'm not sure because there's one little piece that I don't have, and Jesus knew that he was good, had the power to be raised again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, as a Christian, there comes a line when, okay, I'm to be Christ-like, but there's a limit to that because I'm not omniscient. I'm not all-powerful. You know, I don't know the end from the beginning. Yes, I'm compassionate. I forgive. If God convinces me that I should be walked on as a doormat, I shouldn't rebel against that. But that doesn't mean just because I have the example of Christ who died for the sinner, died for those who were dead, you know, we can't move that extension all the way out and say, okay, we just give everything away. You know, the whole idea that, you know, kind of like priests have, you know, we don't have anything, we don't get married, you know, we just, it's all living in poverty to gain the...
Well, that very idea flies in the face of biblical stewardship, in which you're given something and then you have an accounting for what you did with what you were given. And how in the world do you not have an accounting if there are no walls, if there are no safes, or if there are no doors, if there's no management? Lord, you gave me five, I have no idea what happened to them. You know, that's not what you get there. It is, you know, I carefully took what you gave me and did something with it. And so both things are necessary. There are times when Paul was whipped. There are times when he took a beating. There are other times when he left the city.
Right.
You know?
And it's difficult to figure out because when you read the New Testament, it seems like, to me, the expectation was it was going to be over like that. You know, Paul said, you know, don't have things. It'd be better if you don't get married because the end's coming. It's here, it's here, it's here. But now here we sit, you know, 2,000 plus years later going, okay, how do I fit this into what I'm going to do in my brand new building in this really nice church that I go to?
Right. Mm-hmm. With the reality that we could be in the final generation or Jesus might not come
right.
for another 100 years.
And with the reality that half a world away, Joey Kellett is in Thailand in not so good circumstances.
Or at least listen to us.
Well, that's true.
Could be worse.
Yeah, so they could.
I mean, he'd be in a place where he
could
have to watch his favorite NFL team at the Super Bowl.
I'm just worried about it at the Super Bowl.
But, you know, if we take this, though, and we've said, we definitely have the right as a nation to sovereignly protect our borders
mm-hmm.
and determine who and who can't come in. And then the idea is, okay, once they're here and they're here, how they got here, I'm a Christian. I got this guy who's living in peace. He may or may not be an illegal. I don't know, unless I point blank ask. But he's here. He's being productive. How much responsibility do I have in Christian compassion to care for him? And the reason why I ask that is because over in Sampson County, it's estimated there are 17,000 illegal immigrants who are doing most of the farming
right.
that provides majority of the produce that we buy at Food Lion
mm-hmm. yep.
within our own state.
Yep.
And New South River Baptist Association here in our county constantly gets together three times a year, a medical team and dentistry team, to take a wagon trailer over there and goes into the area where they suspect that most of the people are illegals, and they provide donated.
And I would argue that that is in keeping with the Matthew 25 application that he said
exactly.
that very well is that, and that's all appropriate stuff. Likewise, if the government chooses to enforce its immigration rules and does something about that,
and they go in and clean out,
then they do that, then I step back and say that's the God's will, the governing authority is doing that. That doesn't keep me from even giving them a bottle of water
right.
On the way to the process, because I don't have to have an animosity towards them. I don't have to have
a
hatred
towards
them.
And it's almost like we have to pick. You either have to hate them
yeah.
or you have to be, you know.
Yeah, the only streams. You
know? No, I don't have to be there.
Yeah, let's talk about refugee cities in the same way. You know, the fact is that if the United States, the fact is the United States does have these immigration laws and that people are here illegally. We know those two facts to be true. And so if I'm a citizen, I have a choice. If I know my neighbor is an illegal, I have a choice whether to tell ICE if they haven't found them already. You know, I mean, I do.
Right.
I have a choice. It's not really my job like the ICE's job to enforce that law, even though I know that it exists. I don't get paid a salary.
No, you don't. You don't. But your conscience dictates
right.
what
so,
you need to do.
So my point is, I have the ability, you know, right or wrong, heaven to earth, I have the ability to keep my mouth shut or say something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are my two choices.
Right, and you're commanded to love your neighbor as yourself. So if you knew that someone was planning to do harm to you, would you want someone else to say something about it, or would you want them to keep their mouth shut? If the answer is you would want them to say something, then you're obligated that if you see something, you must say something, because you have to say, what would I want done to me? Then there's an application of what he called the golden rule. And that's a legitimate application. But if they're just a law-abiding citizen working next door...
They wouldn't be a citizen.
No, you're right. A resident. A law-abiding resident. And you think of them as a citizen, and there's no reason to think of them. Be kind. That's your neighbor. Share the gospel with them.
But even, you know, at John's point, even if you know they're illegal, I mean, you would have an obligation to report them, but then... It's kind of out of your hands at that point. because as John said, I can't enforce the immigration
law. That's right. That's
I can
right.
inform
right.
So immigration that, you know, hey, my neighbor is here illegally. They just, you know, they just told me they're an illegal.
Right, agent. And that doesn't give you a justification of being mean
right.
to them.
Right, I can still be right. kind to them. I can still reach out. I can be a Christian to them. And then I'm leaving it in the government's hand if they choose, okay, yeah, we're going to come deport them, or we don't really care about them. We got bigger fish to fry, so oh, well, too bad.
And
at that point, you just say, okay, fine. You know, I reported it. I told them what happened.
That's
it. If they're ignoring it, I'll be kind, loving, generous to them, and help them however I can.
Yeah, Paul was pretty successful with a slave that became a believer in what did that slave
right, and he reported him. You know, it wasn't like, you know, when Onesimus ran away, he didn't just go, okay, well, let me hide you over here. He said, no. He said, you go back where you ought to be, and let me write you a letter and tell Philemon.
Yeah, and that's where you decide, is the Constitution a living, is the Bible a living document that I can do what I want with it? That is to say, you didn't address the slavery the right way, and now I ignore it. Or is that a legitimate application that still has relevance in the year 2017?
And I would say, just me personally, I don't speak for the rest of the staff, but if a person was in that situation, they were living next to a little old lady, really nice lady, but we knew it was illegal. We know no harm. That wasn't even the issue. The issue is, am I going to report this, turn this person in or not? If, you know, Christian A said, I have an obligation to report them, they're breaking the law, turn them in, I would not say, oh, that person was horrible. You know, no compassion, whatever. If person B decided to keep their mouth shut, I also personally wouldn't say, oh, that person is just sinning. And break, because I can see where they could articulate to me, from a biblical standpoint, a reason to keep your mouth shut.
Right, and that's where they might argue that it's better to obey God rather than
exactly.
man in that situation. Mm-hmm. And you just have to respect the fact that we have a different understanding there.
But the narrative today is, if you don't believe our side of things, you're on the wrong side of history, and you are giving false news, fake news.
Yep.
I mean, that's just the way the approach is. If I don't like something I hear, I'm going to find a way to try to say that it's illegal.
And oh, by the way, both sides are doing it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Trump's saying fake news. Anything that he doesn't like is
every
not
other
fake.
Tweet is fake news.
It's just unbelievable. And does he not understand he's losing credibility every single time he does that?
Sure.
I can't even take you serious.
Yeah. Even his Supreme Court nominee came out yesterday and said, it's a little disheartening, all this attack on the judiciary.
Right, right.
Even if some of it's justified.
But he said that to a Democratic senator.
Sure.
Very awkward. All right, well, thanks for listening. Have a great day. Give us your comments. Post a really good one. Bye.